Podcast of the cinema. All right, I have a bone to pick with the reviews.
I wondered if we were going to get into this.
We got a 4-star review. Four,
which stars. In and of itself is a bad enough.
4 stars. 4. I think everyone needs to understand that when you leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts, it is required that you leave a 5-star.
Yes. Or say nothing.
We were taking down a star.
Yes.
For one reason.
Yes. Because
I'm not angry, just disappointed.
We were taking down a star because we introduce each other at the top of the show. And it's like, look, we never know when someone's episode of this show is going to be their first episode of this show.
At first, okay, I'm not disappointed or angry. At first I was like, well, the nerve. And then I decided, because I'm a professional, to take the note.
And so what are you going to do?
Well, then? I think you, Alonzo, you are correct. Mm-hmm. But also, on one level, the 4-star reviewer is correct.
Oh, so you're gonna accept this criticism.
Hang on. I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Because I have the perfect solution.
Okay, what is it?
Well, the line in the review was, for the love of God, stop introducing each other.
Look, you have a 30-second advance button on your podcatcher.
No. Here's the thing. Okay, so, Alonzo, you are right. Every episode is someone's first.
Yes.
And you have to know who we are.
Yes.
You have to know that my name is Dave White.
Yes.
You have to know that your name is Alonzo Duralde.
Correct.
And that we are both film critics, actual working film critics.
Yes.
Real life film critics.
Yes.
Not just dreamland film critics.
No.
Okay. But it's not actually necessary that I list out your entire credits roll.
Oh, I would rather you didn't.
Each time.
Great.
And I don't really have one other than, you know, the little bits here and there that I do for various places. So I think the compromise here is we say our names. We move on to important subjects like what I'm making for dinner.
Absolutely.
All right. So, reviewing friend who loves us, but for the love of God, we must stop introducing each other. We hear you.
Yes.
We see you.
We see your 4 stars.
And what you're going to do for us. Bump up that star.
If one can, I don't know if you get to go back and change your own.
Oh, do you not? Oh,
I don't know. Do. I don't know.
I bet you get to fix it if you know that you have made a grave error.
Well, anyway.
Hang on just a second.
Okay.
I'm not done.
Yes.
In 1984, I was young.
Okay, well, no. You're cutting off a thing that I was going to say.
What were you going to say?
Well, what I was going to say was I'm sure we do have some first-time listeners because we have a very exciting guest with us.
And this episode is going to be a little different than the normal episode because normally we review a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even if we have a guest, the guest takes up a little bit of time and then we either let the guest sit in or we kick them out.
Or the guest has seen some movies, depending, you never know.
But we have a guest today. Who just might take up the whole time.
And we're fine with that.
We're not just fine with that. We're enthusiastically consenting.
There's a deep dive to be made today.
Because, see, so if we don't get to the other movies to review today, then maybe we'll do an extra episode tomorrow. Who knows what we're going to do?
Right.
You don't know, listener, because even we don't know right now.
Right.
We're at the very beginning of the episode.
But we're going to take advantage of this stellar opportunity.
Right. Because we got her here in our apartment.
We do.
And the door's locked.
And so she can stop sitting here mutely. Why don't we just say we're delighted to have legendary actress Lisa Jane Persky on the show today. Welcome.
Hello. I thought that I was coming to a manor because, you know, I listened to the show.
Well, we are broadcasting.
I was expecting a manor, but actually we're listener broadcasting from the Rambo Ranch.
Yes, in the series of tunnels underneath.
This is do not mess Stately with Harper Manor. Anyone at Linoleum Knife.
In 1984, I saw The Cotton Club. 84. I said 1984. I think you said 94. I saw The Cotton Club. I saw it at the United Artists North Star 8 in Garland, Texas, one block from my family's apartment building. It was Christmas break. I was bored. I was like, I'm going to walk up to the movies and see what's happening. I walk in, I go, I haven't seen The Cotton Club yet. I'm going to see The Cotton Club. I like Francis Ford Coppola. Who doesn't? I walked out of that movie when it was over, and I thought, what in the heck was that that I just watched? What did I see? I don't know what I just saw. A collage of sounds and images.
It was one of the first movies that I reviewed for my college paper.
Yes.
Because it came out at the end of 84, so it was during my freshman year.
Yeah.
And I remember being impressed with it, but impressed in that way of like, there's another movie here that's not this movie.
I wasn't at the point in my film going life where I thought about there's another movie here. I just thought, they just did something that I didn't care about.
I had been reading the many articles about the troubled production, which we can get into and find out what it was like to be in it. But that was it was infamous at the time because like, script revisions every day and Robert Evans is coked out of his mind and there's money coming from shadowy forces and we don't know what's going on and no one's running the ship and, you know, it's a Baudelaireized version that's being released to theaters.
Right.
Anyway, so yeah, the movie opened with a lot of fanfare, went nowhere, kind of went away. But now we're in the phase of the Francis Ford Coppola career where pretty much everything he's ever done is being zhuzhed. You know, I don't know how many Apocalypse Now versions we've had now. There was another year.
There's no third.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now, so in at Telluride 2018, he premiered what is called the Cotton Club Encore, which is a new cut that he has personally supervised.
Yes.
And it just played at the New York Film Festival. It opened this weekend in New York and Los Angeles, and it's coming out on Blu-ray in December. And we are thrilled that we have one of the stars of the film here to tell us.
The film has about 25 extra minutes of stuff that you have not seen, or things that are both big and small.
Yeah.
And it has been, we saw it Friday at 5 p.m. at the New York, at the New Art here in Los Angeles. As we were walking out, up walks our guest.
For the 8th walk.
We have a wonderful meeting on the sidewalk. And, for me, the one of the most interesting thing about it, one of the most interesting things about it, knowing that she was going to come on the show, is noticing you. Because initially, seeing it in 84, I didn't know you from a can of paint. I had no idea who you were. I had seen you in The Great Santini, but I had not made that connection in my head. I wasn't thinking, oh, that's the woman who was the daughter in The Great Santini.
When I saw The Great Santini, that became, I have that moment, and I've talked about this with other performers, where I'm like, I'm learning your name. I'm learning your name, and I'm going to track you through things, because you are special, and you are gifted, and you are this extraordinary character actress. And so, like, when you later turned up in The Sure Thing, and when Harry Met Sally, and The Big Easy, I was like, Lisa Jane Persky. Never in my life did I think I was going to know Lisa Jane Persky, but like I've been a fan for quite a while.
Right. Yeah. So that was one of the great things. That's one of the wonderful things about living in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Is getting to know Lisa Jane and her husband Andy and becoming friends and adoring both of them.
Yes.
And we're so very happy today to have you here.
Thank you. It was so fun to run into you on the street. I hadn't seen it yet, so I just went. And I assumed that I wasn't going to see anybody I knew, but I was surprised to see you guys because I thought you guys just get into that. You get into screening.
They had a press screening that we both missed for whatever
reason. Yeah, it was. Well, Lionsgate is doing the reissue, and they like to screen at their place in Santa Monica, which is a schlep for us.
Yeah.
And someone threw his back out and was not really feeling the drive.
That's been
an
odyssey
lately. We were like, we're buying a ticket. And we did.
Well, so did we. And we were so happy to see you.
And I was so happy to see this film.
Yeah.
Because this is a different movie than the one that I saw in 1984. This is something that feels more whole and more full, even though I didn't know at the time that it wasn't. I didn't know all of the controversies. I didn't know all of the troubles. I didn't know anything. I was just some dummy in the audience going, I have no idea why I'm watching this. And now I feel like I know why I watched it. It's this beautiful, it's still a collage, but it's so much more full and real, and there is a narrative that is bubbling under everything that you're being thrown, that everything that's being thrown at you. And I think it's gorgeous now and complete in a way that I didn't feel when I saw it. I'm as a reviewer, I am telling everyone, watch this now.
Yes,
if you are in New York or Los Angeles where it's playing theatrically, go. If you don't have access to it right now, December, you'll get a chance.
So, Lisa Jane, take us
back.
I concur.
I think it's really good to go to that because it takes you through an era that is exciting to look at and it has relevance today.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that's – I concur. Go see this movie.
And if you need another selling point, there is a restored Jack Hay musical number.
Holy
cow.
That will
knock your socks off.
The minute she walked in, the minute she showed up on stage and started singing, I was like, that's Jack Hay. That's Jack Hay. We're like looking at her like, ah.
It will give you goosebumps.
Yeah.
As will Creole Love Song, which is
yes.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, that woman is so exquisite. And the cinematography. Anyway, I always thought this movie could be better. Because the experience of it was so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And the experience of it wasn't the same as, you know, you can never make a film the same. It doesn't come off the screen in the same way as you experience it.
Sure.
So for me, as an actor, always the best thing is just having, you know, the actual doing of it. And then sometimes I don't even see it until much later.
So tell us about, take us back to the beginning of this process for you. Is this a part you read for? Did they ask for you? Did you audition? How did it happen?
Well, I'm told that the reason that I got to meet Francis, which is what I met Fred Roos, the producer, mm-hmm. who is also a casting director, as you know, and Fred had heard about me, I think. Well, he'd seen my work, but he had heard about me from Ralph Bakshi.
Hmm.
I had been working as a cell painter on The Lord of the Rings.
Thing I did not know. Okay, wow.
And this was such a great job. I wish it still existed, and I would just be doing it right now because it's so relaxing. But it's probably the most mellow I ever was, the most meditative job. No one else was mellow at that job because they were racing to get that film finished. But anyway, when I was painting cells at Bakshi on Sunset, somebody who worked with him came to the table and said, "Ralph wants to see you." And I thought I was going to be fired. And I went up in the elevator to Ralph's office, and he said, "You know, I'm making this movie about the history of American pop music, and here's how we're going to do it." And he explained green screen to me, and you know, it was one of the first films done that way.
Like rotoscope,
said,
right?
And he said, "When I told him that I told him I was an actress, he didn't know I was an actress, and I said I was about to go make The Great Santini, and so I was going to be gone for a while." And he said, "Well, when you come back, I want you to be in this movie, American Pop." So he told Fred about me, and then Fred had me come and meet Francis. And when I talked to him, and when I talked to Mr. Coppola, because to me it was like, oh my gosh, I'm meeting Francis Ford Coppola. He was such a hero to me. And we talked, he just talked to me about what he was trying to do, and he talked to me, and we talked about books from that period, and that was it. I had this nice half hour, 40-minute conversation with him, where we talked about Carl Van Vechten. You know, we talked about Harlem of that period. We talked about Busby Berkeley, films like that from that period. And then I never heard anything for 3 months. And later I found out that he put my picture on the wall right away, and they were like, this is who this is. We're hiring her.
Oh, right away.
And I just thought, like, okay, that I guess I'm not going to read for that. But I never did audition, actually. So.
Wow. Oh, cool.
So, yeah, it was a very happy surprise when I got the job. And then we were all, the whole cast was called to New York, and I think it was in July. And
of what year?
Of 82.
Okay.
Or 83. I'm not good with years, but must have been 82.
Okay.
So we were called to New York, and we were told we were going to be there maybe 3 months. And really, he brought the whole cast. And the whole cast was there the whole time, pretty much. So, and we were summoned to Astoria Studios, which was just reopening. And we all sat around a big, long table that was shaped in tables that were put together to shape in the shape of a U in this huge room. And gradually, by, I guess, 10 o'clock in the morning, everyone showed up except for, I think, a couple people, Bob Hoskins most notably, because when he got there, I nearly fell over dead because I was so excited to see him, because I had seen that wonderful movie, The Long Good Friday.
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh,
you know, I just thought, this is the most powerful actor I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, just what a performance, right? So there was a script, and we were given the script, the first and only white pages, and we read that script, and there was, I had one line in it, which was actually not actually a line. It was, I throw myself over Dutch Schultz's body and I wail. And that was it. And but the story was a gangster story, very typical gangster story. It was written by Mario Puzo.
Right.
And there was Cotton Club in the background. And that's really it. So there was no black story. And so anyway, Francis, so we read through the script, but he said, this is not going to be, you know, the script. And we're waiting for pages. Pages are being produced. You know, he had been rewriting, I guess, and doing things. But he said, this is how we're going to do this. We're going to rehearse with green screen. We have, I think, 2 weeks to rehearse. And we'll get to know each other. And, I mean, I wish I could even tell you the way in which he did this. But basically, while we were waiting for new pages, which was some hours, I think we spent at least 4, 5, maybe 6 hours together at the tables. And like I said, at some point Bob Hoskins walked in and I fell over. But the whole time Francis was telling us about himself and about his relationship to the movie and what he wanted to do. And he told us about his teacher Dorothy Arzner, and he told us about how his grandfather made lacquers, you know, shellac records, and about the process of making records, and about being he told us about having polio as a child, and how you know, he would play with puppets, and he would write plays as a child, you know, when he couldn't walk around, and
right.
And he just was so inclusive, you know. Everyone felt immediately like a part of a family. I've never really seen a director do that, so spin that web so well, you know, and be embracing of everyone. He's a true collaborator, is what I want to say. I don't know if producers, you know, or movie companies feel that way. But so the fact that there was never a script really is one of the reasons I think he probably revisited this. But one of the things that is never said, I'm not even giving you a chance to ask me any questions.
Go on,
that
keep
I think
going.
Is interesting we'll about this whole thing is that it was always in his mind this question of what it's like, how people get owned. And I haven't read anything really about that, but I know he talks about that. And so that's the story he was that was in his mind about creating how people are owned. And we're all owned, and that's a very interesting subject for a filmmaker because, you know, you have to get your money from somewhere, and, you know, this is a...
And this was, you know, an interesting period for him because he was coming off of Apocalypse Now, which had gone way over budget, and then, you know, One from the Heart, which had not been successful. So he was sort of trying to kind of get American Zoetrope off the ground and sort of be his own guy, but now he was back to having to have Bob Evans and other people like get the money for him.
And I think that that struggle really made an impact, and that it makes it finally makes it into this film.
Fascinating.
So and it's sort of funny that there's one of the characters is named Oni.
True. Yeah. That's an interesting coincidence. Which is a real guy though.
Yes.
Now let's just for a second.
Yeah.
Just a little interruption here. Let's talk about who's in this film.
Sure.
And people who might not know anything about this movie.
Oh, okay, totally.
It stars. I'm just going to read the list.
Yes.
Obviously, our wonderful friend, Lisa Jane Persky, is in this movie. But also, Richard Gere, Gregory Hines, Diane Lane, Lonette McKee, Bob Hoskins, James Remar, Nicolas Cage, Alan Garfield, Fred Gwynne, Gwen Verdon, Maurice Hines, Novella Nelson, Lawrence Fishburne, Tom Waits,
Jennifer
Grey, Joe D'Alessandro, Diane Venora,
Tom Waits,
who I missed like somehow in the, I didn't even see her. Yeah, lots of people.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, the table, I was just in awe.
I think it's Richard E. Grant in his, he has this great book of set diaries called With Nails, and he talks about doing Bram Stoker's Dracula and says that there were a lot of like communal dinners that the Coppola was very into, like having, you know, bring everybody together. They were like, I think near the winery and stuff. And there were a lot of like cast dinners and, you know, everybody sort of sitting down. Is that your recollection of...
Well, we didn't have dinners because we worked pretty much around the clock.
Oh,
but
gotcha.
We did have... But he did hire people to cook lunch for us in a dining room. Mm. So we would go to a dining room where there were tablecloths and everything. You know, as it was part of the Cotton Club experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we had these lovely meals together. But it wasn't always together. The meals that I remember having were always with Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis, who happened to just be there.
Oh, wow.
And for some reason, they were there when I was there, because you just, when you weren't rehearsing, you could go get your lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was fortunate enough to sit with Ruby and Ossie a few times.
Oh, wow.
Who came by for lunch.
Lovely.
And you know, and speaking of food, one of the, I think, for me, iconic images of this film that I had sort of forgotten about until watching it again was you eating black olives off the ends of your fingers. There's something about that moment that just, like, tells you so much about who this woman is.
Right. No, it really does, because one of the things about you in this film that I now, you know, I can, I'm watching it now, and I'm watching your character deal with the fact that you are married to a terrifying man. He's a psychotic person, and and he is capable and very willing to take a giant knife and stab someone in the throat at a dinner and know that he will get away with it, at murdering someone in front of dozens of other people, and he will walk out of the room without like any repercussions.
Which sort of
that's
limits
your husband in the film. And so
limits what you can do as a wronged wife.
So you have these, you have two, you know, different ways you can go. You can be like, I'm scared of this person, or you can be the one person who can talk to him in the way that no one else talks to him. And that's what you do in the film. And so when you're there, you pop because you're delivering lines like, and so much of this film is like a 1930s movie film.
Yeah.
You're delivering lines that are like characters in those kinds of movies, are this very sort of, you know, snappy, tough talking.
Yeah.
Sort
you're
of,
like the Joan Blondell Dane.
Yeah. And so you're, I'm not saying this simply because I know and adore you. You're so cool. In this movie, because you're the person that the audience wants to be. You want to be able to go up to James Remar and say, "You're not so big." You know what I mean? Like that's how you treat him, and it's really wonderful to watch.
Thank you. So we improvised for 2 weeks basically, and a lot of what we improvised made it into the movie. And James Remar was always saying to me, "Stop needling me." Like, he did not want a wife like this, which made me, of course, I was encouraged by that. So I went deeper. But I always loved those character actresses, like the Lane sisters, you know?
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Priscilla. And
the a lot, especially like the slightly down at their heels kind of babes. And,
right.
And who don't get everything.
Aileen McMahon.
Yeah, it's so cool, right? And so anyway, it was for me, and I loved this period, so it was really fun to play with the language of the period and certainly the costumes. And
yeah, is this like your outfittiest movie in terms of, you've got some gowns.
Yes.
And hats.
Okay, hats and the sunglasses and the gloves.
Yes. Well, so I always, you know, I grew up in Greenwich Village, and when I was very young, I worked for this couturier, Charles James, who is has had a second coming. And, you know, he was a phenomenal man, very down on his luck when I worked for him. And I got paid $1.50, I think, an hour to work for him and help him keep his together. But excuse me. But anyway, do we need to?
It's okay. I'll just take it out later.
You can take it out later.
Okay, so. Should I repeat it?
No.
Sorry. Anyway, so I worked for him, and he had a couple of rooms in the Chelsea Hotel, and he was always telling me that I should, you know, follow my muse and be an actress, and he wanted me to be in The Bad Seed. Anyway, he thought I would be good as that little girl. So he was a great influence on me. I learned a lot about not just cut and fit, but about that era, Stutz Bearcats, and he's the one who taught me about Carl Van Vechten.
Yeah.
So he would give me books. Anyway, so to work with Milena Cannonero was, you know, a real honor and privilege, and. You know, I told her when I was working with her that I had worked for Charles. And so from then on, and even now, she calls me Lisa James.
Nice.
Yeah, we're still friends, and she's just the most amazing person. But yeah, to play with all those clothes, and, you know, things weren't cut on the bias anymore.
Mm.
So she had to find somebody who could cut on the bias to make those gowns hang the way they hang.
Right, right.
And that was John Schneeman, who's still around and making beautiful clothes.
You know, speaking of your sort of your own early years and how they connect with this film, you know, you come out of a New York experimental theater background. Some of your earliest work was at La Mama, and then you've got Julian Beck in this film.
Yes.
You know, who I think most of our listeners will know him as the Poltergeist 2 "You Are Gonna Die" guy, but is very much a key figure from that theater. Had you worked with him before?
I'd never worked with him, but, you know, we knew each other from the Village. And this is a fun thing about my career. As I went on, I worked with Charles Ludlam a movie in The Big Easy.
Oh, that's right.
And who I knew from growing up in the Village.
Oh, funny.
And with John Fleck. Oh. I worked with John Fleck on Man and Machine. I don't know if you remember that
TV show.
Yeah. But yeah, we had so much fun together doing that show. And, you know, so throughout my my career, I got to work with people from the neighborhood, and I always sort of felt like that's when it was really working for me, was when I was able to touch base with home somehow.
Hmm.
So, yeah. Anyway, Julian, there's a little scene that's cut with me and Julian that's in the original 1984 movie. But, mm-hmm. you know, there's 9 minutes they couldn't find of the film, minutes of footage that they just couldn't find. So I don't know if that's part of that or not, but it really wasn't. It was just a nice moment that Julian and I had together.
Oh, well, hope it turns up.
Yeah, it's fine. I didn't even know I was still in the movie. You know, I was just thrilled to still be there.
Right. Now, before we started recording, you showed us
a treasure trove
of so many things, stuff from the film. But what the most interesting thing to me, aside from the cool detailed Cotton Club menus and programs, is a handwritten paper where you wrote down ideas about your character.
Yeah.
And so Frances, how do I say her last name? Flagenheimer. She's a real person.
And yeah, and also Lisa Jane brought a photo of her in which you look extraordinarily like her.
What I really find interesting about how actors prepare for work, regardless of whether it gets, you know, used or not, is that you are carrying around all this information that you know about your character. If it's a real person, maybe you've done, you know, biographical research, but if it's a fictional person, you've still done this work on yourself. And so many of the things that I sort of scanning through the thing, they really do come through in how you are on screen. And that's always one of the things about actors that I'm fascinated by and will always be a mystery to me, because I'm not an actor. And I don't know how you become that other person.
I'm not an actor either. I don't know what I am, but you know, to me, I was lucky. I got to work with Louis John Carlino. I got to work with Robert M. Young. Mm-hmm. I got to work with Francis Ford Coppola. I got to work with these people right at the beginning of my career, really. Mm-hmm. And they were really highly ethical people, and they were interested in the process, and they wanted everyone to come. They wanted to bring everybody along with that, in that way. And so a lot of everything after is kind of a disappointment to me in some ways,
mm-hmm.
Because I expected this high standard
for the
rest of my career.
Yeah.
Right. But so one of the things Francis had us do was write these biographies of ourselves, these autobiographical sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it was so important to rehearse. To have rehearsal time. And those three instances with those three directors that I mentioned, there was rehearsal, and there was rehearsal with everyone, because you had to feel like the connection and this family feeling, so that you could really do your job in a comfortable, safe situation. And I've never really been any good without that. I think I need that. I like it.
I'm curious, because I've heard it, I've heard people describe different directors in different ways about this sort of thing, but like, when you guys would rehearse, would he eventually do the blocking as far as like, here's where the camera's going to be and here's all that stuff, based on what you guys came up with through rehearsal? Or did you do the rehearsal with him having already said, all right, you enter from here, you're standing here, you know, do you remember?
Yeah. I mean, no, there wasn't, no, it was just a open space with mm-hmm. a green, you know, with a background. And we could sort of do whatever we wanted in that space. When it was your turn to, mm-hmm. you know, work on a scene or make something up, you know,
right.
be spontaneous, you just went in and you did it. And you know, and we were developing our relationships outside too.
True.
And we were together so much that we only, so many hours a day that we only had each other.
Mm-hmm.
So these relationships did develop. And you can see it in the smallest role, like Ed Popke, Glenn Withrow. You know, he's so rich in his moment that you see on screen where he gets popped, right?
Right.
And that's because of all the background work that is done, and the closeness that we all carried, yeah. Thanks to the great leader that right. we had.
Which is, I think, doubly challenging to allow for the time of that, because this movie is also a musical. Like, there are a mm-hmm. lot of numbers, choreographed dance numbers, which involve, like, you know, a whole separate kind of, like, camera movement and editing and planning for what shooting that is going to be. So, you know, he's got to juggle. He's got a lot of plates he's spinning in terms of, you know, on the one hand, it's a gangster drama and it's a, you know, drama about like relationships and families and whatnot. And then also it's like, it is set in this venue that is legendary for these performances that he has to then also capture.
Yeah. My favorite scene with the white people is, I have a lot of them, but Fred Gwynne and Bob Hoskins, when Fred gets returned
yes.
to yes. Oni Madden, played by Bob Hoskins. And that scene, there may have been a little of that dialogue in the script originally, but they made that all up, that with the watch and
oh, wow.
everything. That was them playing together. And, you know, when they met on this movie, and they yeah. became really, really close friends, like besties immediately. And they were the two of them. Look, we spent 20 hours a day there sometimes in this dark studio, mostly right. in this studio and in these little rooms where we had to share dressing rooms. And Tom Waits and myself and Alan Garfield shared a dressing room. And
they made you share a dressing room with men?
Well, they didn't make us. We just teamed up, and it's kind of how it worked out. Okay. It's kind of how it worked out, you know.
I've got HR on the line.
I didn't have to change in front of them or anything. No one held me down. And, you know, it was very friendly.
Gotcha.
And Bob and Fred shared a dressing room, and all during the shooting. When we were at Astoria Studios, and Bob and Fred and I all lived in the Village, so we would share a cab home, mm-hmm. and they loved to like rib me, and yeah. that was fun for them, and it was fun for me too, but about my boyfriend who was waiting at home for me with a designer salad, like that was one of their favorite things to poke me with, but they stayed in the dressing rooms were open and everybody was stopping by all the time, but the two of them would stay in there, and they felt to me the most like jurors on a terribly long trial.
Two angry men.
They were very funny about it. They weren't whiners or anything, but anyway, Fred is he was a talented artist, a brilliant actor. He made beautiful sculptures. He wrote books. He wrote children's books. He illustrated children's books. I recommend you find them and get them. They're wonderful books.
I never knew this.
And he would make sculptures out of the wire hangers all day long. I'm looking at the Joan Crawford book on the shelf. So, and then he had this, they had a bulletin board in there, and so he kept pinning them up on the bulletin board. And I have some pictures of those too, but they're just wonderful, you know, whimsical birds and all kinds of
Richard Tuttle. Putting wire on a wall. Like, here it is. the scene you were talking about earlier with Fred Gwynne and Bob Hoskins is what it's the moment when Fred Gwynne is returned from being held hostage
by Nicolas Cage.
And as I watched that scene play out, so my jaw just sort of like started dropping. And when the movie was over, I turned to Alonzo and I said, those guys were lovers. It's never spoken. Those characters were lovers. I can't be reading this in. They loved each other so much. And you could just feel that friendship.
Yes.
But like, my first thought was, those characters were lovers. We'll never know, but they were lovers.
Yeah, we'll never know, but yeah. but Fred and Bob did. They fell in love with each other, and they were friends until the very end. Mm. And I hated for either of them to have to lose one another. I think Bob. I don't know.
Fred died first earlier.
Yeah,
they both passed.
Anyway, it's a terrible loss.
Yeah, no, that is a really, really vibrant scene, and the minute it was over, first he said Jack Hay, and I was like, no, the other one.
It's interesting that you talk about the Puzo draft, the original reading, being so much about the gangster story because. You know, the whole thing about the Cotton Club itself and that the movie touches on many occasions is this notion that it was a place where only black people were on stage, but none of them were in the audience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so the idea that someone would then make a movie that was all about the white people in the audience of the Cotton Club, I'm sure Francis was like, no, I can't. We're not doing that movie.
Right.
Yeah, no, that wasn't Francis's idea.
And this cut, I understand, has a lot more of the Gregory Hines storyline than the previous version did. So he is kind of, in this version, definitely comes off as a co-lead with Richard Gere and that storyline.
His trajectory and Richard Gere's at the same time.
Yeah.
I'd say there's one of the things that people who want more traditional narrative plotting, like this happens and then this happens and then this happens, and they react to the thing that just happened and that's why they begin to do this other thing. You're not going to get that here. That's not the kind of movie it is.
I kind of had to let that go. Like, you're not going to get a lot of passage of time montages telling you what's happening. Like, you'll pop into a scene with a character you haven't seen in a while. Someone will tell you very quickly what has been happening since the last time you saw them. And that's it.
And now we're here.
And then go.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, the way the stories come together is basically that the white story and the black story is that Richard Gere and his mother live in Harlem and so he knows Dixie because Dixie knows the Gregory Hines character, the Sandman. He knows him because they live in Harlem together, and the movie has very much the feel of living in a city, I think.
I was very impressed by the fact there was a couple scenes in front of the Cotton Club where it's winter and people are talking to each other and you can see their breath.
Right. That never happens anymore. I notice that too in every film when it's cold.
Because I watch a lot of Hallmark Christmas movies and it never happens.
Yeah. Was that Murder on the Orient Express recently, the recent one?
Oh, right.
No breath at all.
I know. It's like none. They're supposed to be in the middle of the freezing mountains and they're like wearing like a jacket.
Well, they're inside somewhere.
Can't that be CG?
But even when they leave the train and they're like sitting outside in that tunnel, like no one's bundled up and there's no breath. And
that seems like an easy CGI thing. I don't know. Because I don't know how to do it. But.
Yeah, you could you could approximate.
You could add it later.
In digital, you could be like, okay, it's cold, so we're going to give them breath. You know? Anyway.
Characters breathe.
So I alluded to this before, that one of the sort of legends of this film was that by the end of it, like the scripts were a rainbow because every day it was new colored pages. And you even mentioned the only white read-through. Like on a typical day that you were going to shoot, would the day start with, oh, by the way, here's the new scene?
Yes. I mean, the script pages were being made from our improvs and, you know, from the scenes that Francis would ask us to act out or improvise. And then eventually William Kennedy came. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how soon he showed up, but it wasn't right away.
Okay.
And because... You know, you can't, as a director, as an actor, the film can't continue. It's going to happen, and it can't continue without a script. And
kind of necessary, yeah.
And so, but it had to.
Sure.
So really, you know, all the dancing was going on, all the numbers were chosen, everything that could be chosen ahead of time and worked on was being worked on.
Sure.
I learned the rumba, because Richard Gere and I had a scene where we did the rumba together, just brief. It was brief, but, you know, we were all doing all these things all the time, and shooting was going to start on the date that shooting was going to start. Mm-hmm. So There never really was a whole script. It never felt like there was a completed script throughout shooting, even though there probably was. It never really. And so I'm not surprised for that reason alone that Francis wanted to go back and make the story more clear.
Sure.
But in my experience, if you don't have a really great script to begin with, you just don't have a great movie. It's really hard. So, and it's really hard to make the great movie from, you know, what was limited at that time. So I think this is probably the best it can be from that. But, and I think, as I said, that is good enough to see because there is so much excellence in this film.
But this experience stands out to you as a film actress in terms of it was unusual to be getting this many revisions this late in the game. And unlike other shoots you've been on where they gave you a script at the beginning and that was pretty much what you were working with the whole time.
Yeah, this was probably the most. This is probably the most. And the least would be The Great Santini because of all the movies I've ever worked on, that is the best. That was the best script from the beginning, and it really never changed. And the only other script I ever read that was as good as that script was Terms of Endearment.
Wow.
You know, it was just together.
Both based on novels.
Yeah.
That's a connection. There's a lot of terrible movies based on novels.
Yeah.
Just looking for a through line.
Let's pick one of those terrible ones.
Did it wind up being a lot longer than you originally thought it was going
to
be?
So, yeah, it was, I think it was supposed to be maybe 2 to 3 months, and it was 6 months.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we got to know it. It got right up on Christmas, and then we all finished. Mm. So, yeah. And I hated to leave. I may be the only person who, you know, because I didn't have the biggest role, and we were encouraged to show up anyway. Uh-huh. I was there every day for the whole thing. I didn't want to go home. I mean, everyone wanted to go home, believe me, but me. I just was like, this is the most, how am I even getting to see all these talented people do all these things all day long?
I'm having lunch with Ruby and Ossie. Come on.
Right. It was just, you know, heaven for me.
Wow. I think that if you are in an environment that you are in love with and that you find exciting, yeah, you want to be there all day.
Yeah.
You know, yeah,
it's nurturing.
You might not have a scene that day, but you want to come watch.
Yeah.
You know, you want to see it all happening.
And it was encouraged because, you know, most things I've worked on, they don't want you there. They don't.
Right,
because
you're in the way.
It's not me that they don't want. Right. I'm not saying that. It's that they don't want people, you know, coming and hanging out and bonding and all that. They don't want that. Let's not have that.
So the film wraps. You know, he takes it to the editing room, which I'm sure was a whole other epic saga. Do you remember seeing the 84 cut for the first time? Did you go to the premiere?
I don't think I went to a premiere. I went to see it at the theater that no longer exists on Westwood Boulevard. And I remember, I'm very critical of myself. So I liked the film a lot, but I didn't like seeing myself, but that's always the case. It's always the case. I need to, somebody who takes pictures of other people, I always say, like, if you don't like this picture, talk to me in 10 years. So another scene.
What is that with actors who don't, and it seems like it's very common, they don't want to see themselves in the movie. They don't want to watch the finished thing.
Just hearing our mic check at the beginning, you were like, my voice, and you put your hands up on your ears.
Yes.
Like,
what, do you have any insight on what that means, what that's about? Because I've always been interested in that. When I see someone on a talk show, and they're like, oh, blah, 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 you're in this movie. Have you seen the movie? They're like, no, I'm not. I don't watch myself in movies. And I'm like, what? I would be right there trying to scrutinize everything I had done, you know?
I know people who go to dailies and everything like that. I just never know. It's because I guess it's because I have low self-esteem. I don't know. But like Duvall said, he never went to see himself.
Right.
I don't believe that. But mostly he didn't.
Right.
And it messes with you. It just messes with you. It's not who. It's not you.
Right.
And it's never. It's never. Just like so. Just like now. And filmmakers never were able to do this. But now filmmakers like Francis can go back to a movie and they can fix things to make the story what they wanted to make it or, you know, do a director's cut. So actors can't do that. We can't go back and go like, oh, that needed another beat, you know.
Barbara Streisand can.
Okay. She's the director, too, though,
well,
right?
No. On A Star Is Born, she went back and
did it. Oh, yeah.
She was,
okay,
like, producer, I guess. Also.
Yeah. Yeah, that helps. Sure. So,
but yes, that's the exception.
So,
I get it.
So when I see myself, I think, like, ooh, I missed that one little hair of a, you know, or I hate the way I look. Or, you know, I mean, I of course, I looked at myself from the neck down. And I was like, these are gorgeous clothes, you know? And no, I think that I look as good as I could possibly look. But so the first thing you see is the way you look.
Right.
And then.
And just for the record, listeners, from head to toe, she looks cool.
Stunning.
Yeah.
And you go, am I attracted to that? I don't think so. That's just me. No, it's some character. Who is that? It's hard to be objective. It's just impossible.
Well, I think what's interesting about, you know, just even this sort of little chunk of your career, you know, in a very quick succession, you have Great Santini, where you are playing an awkward teenager in a very kind of like gawky body language, you know, like uncomfortable in her own skin kind of way. And this is a woman who enters a room. And she's
right.
wearing a gown, and her hair is marcelled, and she may be a little brash, and she may not be refined, but she is a woman. And you know, the very little time has passed between you doing those things. You're bringing that stuff to it, and it's as though you'd filmed them decades apart. That impressed me, thinking how quickly, how close these two movies are together. These are two performances that are on totally opposite ends of the scale in terms of how you are presenting and the person that you're being. But they both share a certain wry sense of humor. Like I put you in that Eve Arden category. I think you know how to, you can deliver a devastating one-liner out of the side of your mouth in a movie like this that kills. And those are the actresses and actors that I'm immediately focused on. Like I love a character actress
right.
who comes in, kills it, and then walks
Yeah, because your character brings laughs to this movie just with the way you deliver lines and the things you're
Thanks.
Saying.
Yeah, I hope so. That was, I guess, the only thing that I was slightly disappointed in the first time, first cut, was that I thought I was funnier. And then when I saw it, I thought, like, well, that's not funny. I don't know what happened there.
There's even a moment, like, actually it's right after the olives bit, where you are trying to be funny and not, and delivering that, because I think sometimes it's unclear. When you say they're conquering the world with arithmetic, that seems like you're trying to, that's a line where you're trying to put them down, but it doesn't really quite land. But your version of it is landing because you're making it not land, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Good read.
Thank you.
Then the other thing, you know, that was distracting about shooting that we didn't talk about, but you started to talk about at the very top of the show, was, you know, this so-called Cotton Club murder
all of this. I forgot about that part.
And I just want to address that. But that happened long before when they were first starting to raise the money, and it didn't really have that much to do with the movie. It just, I think, tangentially. Because right before the movie was released, there was a story in New York Magazine, I remember, that Michael Daly wrote, that he had interviewed me and a bunch of people about. And people can probably still find that story, which is, it's interesting, but it kind of tells you the thing. I don't know exactly why, but I think Francis had it in his contract or something that we never saw Robert Evans. He came to the set one time that I know of. Mm-hmm. And we didn't. So, but I think it was, so we had no outside pressure. I mean, Francis did, of course.
Sure.
And everybody said, this is so much money. I remember it was like $20 million at the time or something, and people saying, like, this is the most expensive movie ever made. And I remember thinking, like, really? Because, you know, what's the next? You know, there's always going to be more. Right, it's always going to cost more. But yes, I'm sure it was very expensive. And when, and you get your bang, you know, for your buck when you see the film that, you know, you see all that money.
Yeah.
We didn't have, as actors, we didn't have the pressure on us at all. It was always being taken off, you know, wherever there was. So, for example, Richard Silbert, who's the who's the production designer,
legend.
So his work is so beautiful, and I've always liked him ever since The Pawnbroker. I think he did.
Oh wow! Yeah.
His wife worked with him, and she one day came on set, and she is wonderful.
Anthea.
She came. Charmian.
Oh, sorry.
And she came on set wearing a gas mask one day. And because we were in this little enclosed space, you know, with smoke machines going 24/7, you know, for weeks and weeks on end. And finally, she just decided, like, I can't breathe this anymore. And we were told it was perfectly safe. Who knows? But and we were all smoking. You can see we're all smoking unfiltered cigarettes. And so on. So there was, like, yes, maybe non-toxic smoke, but there was certainly toxic smoke. So she came on the set wearing a gas mask. And I remember, like, the next day you didn't see the gas mask because Francis said, I don't know exactly what he said, but I know he said something along the lines of, you can't wear a gas mask because you don't realize what this is going to do to me. Everybody's going to think they have to wear a gas mask. So there were funny things like that, but when you work together for such a long period and you're doing all these things, yeah. I've never worked on a movie where there wasn't something really dangerous. So,
all four members of KISS.
But at no time were we ever afraid we were going to be murdered.
Well, there's that thing. Yeah. Apart from what your feelings about seeing yourself on screen, having just seen the new cut, what's your takeaway in terms of the change from the previous version?
Well, I got goosebumps from a lot of the musical numbers, and I love musical numbers in any movie.
Sure.
I just love, and I love Elton John more than ever now since seeing that movie about him.
Yeah.
When I saw him in that suit, that he goes to the clinic in.
Yes.
I got goosebumps from that. I just love all the costumes, the musical numbers. There is so much more in evidence in both storylines that is rich to, perceive. I don't want to say too much because I want people to see it. But
is it more reflective of the movie you thought you were making?
Yes.
That you watched being made?
Oh, yes. It definitely is. It definitely is. But I, of course, had this question, like, how can it be done? Because I didn't know what... I knew of some of the footage that we didn't see in the movie originally, but I was very interested in how... most interested in how Francis was going to make the story about what he originally hoped to make the story about, which I think is about, it's not just about race, it's about being owned.
I that absolutely, I think, comes through more in this go around in both of the major storylines, for sure. So you are now, as you say, not a photographer, but taking pictures, or have been at least.
Take pictures.
What are you up to these days? What's keeping you busy?
Well, I just had a show. I had a show in London of my Blondie photographs.
Nice.
I got to be patient zero at CBGB's, which was also another privilege of my life.
Right.
Growing up in Greenwich Village, I'm working on a book. I really understand what it's like to not be able to finish something or to have a hard time finishing something or see an end to a thing now that I'm trying to write a book. And I admire everybody who finishes a project like that more than ever.
Is this a memoir?
Yeah, it's about growing up bohemian between the Beat Generation and the Blank Generation. Mm-hmm. And I write, you know, occasionally for things. And I just wrote a movie review about Sorcerer, which is one of my favorite films, for High Lowbrow. I don't know if anyone reads that online, which is it's a great magazine called High Lowbrow.
We'll put a link in the show notes.
I have a lot of, yep. I have movie fever too.
I was trying to find it recently because I was doing another podcast where we talked about Who Slew Auntie Rue. And I was trying to find your hilarious piece about
Chris Harrington.
Yes, Chris Harrington's funeral. Yeah. And I couldn't find it online.
40 and Times it took all their stuff offline. Ugh. But I have it if you ever want it.
Because that was just genius, and it's one of my favorite pieces.
That was talking about finding yourself somewhere and having, you know, something revealed that you never expect.
Right.
Wow, that was quite an experience.
Lisa Jane, it's been a delight, and it's been so great getting to hang out with you in general. Like I said, longtime fan, and so exciting to see you back on the big screen in this beautifully restored Cotton Club Encore, which, again, it's in New York and Los Angeles, coming out on Blu-ray in December. Y'all, if you can see it projected, for sure, do not miss this opportunity. It's really extraordinary.
Thank you. I am a fan of you and of your audience, who's so articulate and funny and great. So thank you very much for having me.
Where can folks find you online?
Oh, they can find me at, and if anybody has any questions, certainly write to me at LisaJanePersky@gmail.com or Lisa Jane Persky on Twitter, or Lisa Jane Persky, that's PERSKY, on Instagram.
Good on you for nailing down the name, because, you know, that's always tricky with accounts on this thing. So good planning on your part.
So we're at about an hour.
Yeah.
So here's what we should do. So that we can let the listeners know what's happening. This is part one of this episode.
Yes.
So we're going to cut it now, primarily because we have to run off to Pasadena. But
we're going to send it out in the world.
We're going to send it out in the world. And then part two, we will come back and we will do the reviews of the stuff that we have seen this past week.
Yes.
And that'll probably post like on Monday or Tuesday. And then you'll get an extra long linoleum knife cut in half.
Indeed. So yes. Enjoy, everyone.
In the meantime, I might need to make this cake. Our friend brought me a recipe for moist and fluffy devil's food cake.
If you think I'm stopping you, you are wrong.
Which... I don't care if I ever eat another chocolate cake. This is the one.
Really?
And this is from Divas Can Cook online, which I found some time ago. And I swear by her. She's a wonderful cook, but this recipe is divine.
And this is a devil's food cake with white frosting, which, you know what? I haven't had in a long time because I'm usually like chocolate on chocolate, but I'll do it like this.
Make me a cake, Dave White.
Yeah, I've made it with white mountain frosting. Have you ever made that?
No.
The one that you cook, the white frosting that you cook that's like marshmallow and gets like a candy top. That's really good.
Yeah.
I made it with this, and I've made it with chocolate frosting. And if you're an all-chocolate guy, make it with your chocolate frosting.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Or a ganache.
Well, yeah, because ganache is easy.
Yeah.
Ganache is just chocolate and cream.
Right.
And although, you know, I wrecked the ganache the other day, and I'm still down on myself about
that. You need to get back on that bike, then.
Ganache is such a good food word.
It is, ganache.
I made cupcakes for your family when they came to town, and I screwed up the ganache.
It was delicious, it just didn't mirror.
Embarrassed and humiliated to serve the cupcakes.
Stop it.
It's true.
All right, let's let the people go. Lisa Jane, thank you so much for being here. We love you. Everybody, hey, thanks for listening. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at LinoleumCast.
Yes.
Leave us that 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and we'll review it.
Five.
We'll read it on the air, rather.
Five.
Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. As always, you can find him online at Bluetopia.com, BLEU. TOPIA. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We will be back with reviews of this week's movies.
What? We'll talk a little bit more about Cotton Club, more detail-y sure. stuff that we were thinking while we watched
Pain and Glory.
It. Pain and Glory, the new Almodovar, American Factory. And finally, we'll get to talk about The Sound of Silence, which we've been sitting on forever, but it's streaming, so you can watch it.
Right, but there's like big stuff this week. That,
Gemini Man.
Which I haven't watched yet.
Which you're going to go see in its full 175 minutes.
120 frames punishment.
200 frames per second punishment vision.
Why am I blanking on this one? I have no idea what's going on. Anyway,
Adam's Family, but neither of us
saw that Adam's one. You've still got to see Parasite, but we'll get caught up on that probably next week.
Yes.
Anyway,
who knows what we'll do?
More coming.
You'll get reviews.
You will, we promise. All right, thanks for listening, and until next time.
Goodbye.